book on, D'Marl did not write a specific book on the Talmud Brachot. He wrote on other, he had, they found the Perush, his explanations on other parts of Talmud, but not on the tractate of Brachot. Someone wrote a book where he found, he did write, just not under the unorganized, under specifically Brachot. He wrote in other places quoting Talmud Brachot and explaining. So it's going to come in handy here. I looked at it last night, just some ideas of what we just did last week. Okay, so we're on Sfariah. If you can see the screen, is the screen showing it now?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to start from here. So we're going back to this. It's Talmud Brachot 3a, Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Yossi, it was taught in a Braita that Rabbi Yossi said, I was once walking along the road when I entered the ruins of an old abandoned building among the ruins of Jerusalem in order to pray. I noticed that Elijah of blessed memory came and guarded the entrance for me and waited at the entrance until I finished my prayer. When I finished praying and exited the room, Elijah said to me, deferentially as one would address a rabbi, greetings to you, my rabbi. I answered him, greetings to you, my rabbi, my teacher. And Elijah said to me, my son, why did you enter this room? I said to him, in order to pray. And Elijah said to me, you should have prayed on the road. And I said to him, I was unable to pray along the road because I was afraid that I might be interrupted by travelers and would be unable to focus. Elijah said to me, you should have recited the abbreviated prayer instituted for just such circumstances. So now, at that time, Rabbi Yossi concluded, at that time, from that brief exchange, I learned from him three things. I learned that one may not enter a ruin. And I learned that one need not enter a building to pray, but he may pray along the road. And I learned that one who prays along the road recites an abbreviated prayer so that he may maintain his focus. Now listen, it continues on here. This is important to the story. And after this introduction, Elijah said to me, what voice did you hear in that rune? I responded, I heard a heavenly voice, like an echo of that roar of the Holy One, blessed be He, cooing like a dove and saying, woe to the children due to whose sins I destroyed my house, burned my temple, and exiled them among the nations. And Elijah said to me, by your life and by your head, not only did that voice cry out in that moment, but it cries out three times each and every day. Moreover, any time that God's greatness is evoked, such as when Israel enters synagogues and study halls and answers in the Kaddish prayer, may his great name be blessed, the Holy One, blessed be he, shakes his head and says, happy is the king who is thus praised in his house. When the temple stood, this praise was recited there, but now, how great is the pain of the father who exiled his children, and woe to the children who were exiled from their father's table, as their pain only adds to their father. Okay. So now, the Maharal adds, so this beautiful idea that he introduces here. So, he asked the question, what's Rabbi Yossi doing? Okay. If we go back and we ask to stop for a second, we go, okay. So, Rabbi Yossi's walking along. He's in Jerusalem after it has been destroyed, right? He's entered the ruins of an old abandoned building among the ruins of Jerusalem in order to pray. Is that a coincidence? Or is it that it was a setup, like he purposely put himself in that situation? So the Maharal explains that he purposely put himself into that situation because Rabbi Yossi understood, I want to go find God. I'm going to go into the vestiges of Jerusalem. Like God's still there. Like God, even though he destroyed his temple and he's removed himself, so to speak, in a certain way, that there's less of a presence, he understood that if I want to go search out God, I'm going to find him in this place, in the ruins of Jerusalem. And that if you think about the story, notice what happens. It says that he goes in among the ruins of Jerusalem, and he notices Elijah. Okay, so what's Elijah doing there? So already you're getting a sense that Rabbi Yossi understood that if I want to search out God, in a certain way more than I could find them in other places, that I can take advantage of the setting by going here. And he does that. He goes to this place of all places, and he is able to like experience something that he wouldn't have necessarily find in other places. So that's Maharal is giving us that. Additionally, he tells, Maharal explains that if you look at this idea, that after this goes on, Elijah says to him, and by the way, what did you hear in the ruin? So like Elijah's already like, we're getting a sense that there is something in this place that you're going to be able to experience of God's presence or messaging that's going to be unique. And so he did, said, exactly, I did. I heard this voice. What was the voice? It was a voice of a dove cooing. So he said the symbolism is very important here. That the dove is this idea of, we see this, that God and the Jewish people are considered to be like we always have this analogy of it, that we are like a dove to God, God is to us, that the nature of the birds in general, but specific to a dove, is that there is a certain, when it comes to that bird sect, is that the couple, the male female, are completely devoted to each other, specifically to each other, and so that there's no other, they don't look outside of that. So that the idea that we somehow, the Jewish people, have a special relationship with God, similar to the way that you have that devotion between male female with a dove, you have that with God and the Jewish people. So that even though we're talking about a setting of the destruction, a post-destruction of the temple, right? So here, Rav Yossi goes into this place, which is one of the, again, a vestige of the runes. He then goes to pray there, but he also starts hearing, he's almost like hearing God. So like, even though prophecy has gone away, you still see that the rabbis have an ability to tap in and hear God. And you see that he's saying, that God, what's God saying? God is saying, the voice is saying, woe to the children, due to sins I destroyed my house, burned my temple, and exiled them among the nations. But then it brings us back, and it's and teaches us this very important lesson about the importance of, may his great, that when we say, when we go to the synagogue or the study hall, and we say the Kaddish prayer, and we state, may his great name be blessed, the Holy One, blessed be he, shakes his head and says, happy is the king who is thus praised in his house. So that when the temple stood, he had it. And now, unfortunately, it's not going on. But you see this idea of the Maharal is saying that the Gemara is telling us a very powerful, very important, very, you know, idea of the fact that we have this very special relationship with God. That as the Jewish people, we are almost uniquely tied. We are like tied at the hip with God. It's something that's one, like this, the idea of the male, female, the dove, you know, that they're completely devoted to each other. They have a singular devotion. That so to the Jewish people, we see this idea in other Gemaras as well, in many places, that we have this very special connection with God. And that now what he says here, then the Maharal goes on to a very, he has a lengthy discussion about the Kaddish. And he says this line of Yehei Shmei Rabba, may his great name be blessed. So in the Hebrew, or it's really not Hebrew, it's Aramaic, it says Yehei, it's like it should be, right? It's not in the present that it is, but rather it should be Yehei Shmei Rabba, that his name should be, and that there's something very powerful that we're able to, like we're saying, it's not just now, but that God gave us the ability to proclaim it, his name, and to say this is that it should become something that it's not just that it, maybe it is now, but we should really like get the ability to sense God's name to be greater and greater, almost to like make reference to the next world as well. So I was thinking in context of, obviously we can't, all of our synagogues, our shuls, they're all closed right now. So it's probably like difficult to like look at something like this. But the truth is that we have this idea that when you can't actually exercise something to learn about it, to study it, is also very powerful. But I noticed something yesterday. If you look at the screen here, I'm going to show you something from yesterday's Parsha. At the end of the Parsha. And I thought this is pretty wild. So at the end of the putting up of the tabernacle in chapter 40 of Exodus, this is the end of the book of Exodus. And in verse 34 here, it says, "The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle." And then it says, "V'lo yochal Moshe lavo el ha'ol ha'moed." Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle. It was only when the cloud lifted from the tabernacle that the Israelites would set out. But the idea is that a person couldn't enter at that point. So when the tabernacle was finally completed, you had the presence of God fill the temple so much so, the tabernacle so much so that people could not enter. So I was thinking yesterday, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, maybe that's what's happening here, is that we are experiencing a situation. So we don't necessarily feel it, but that the presence of God is so imminent, it's so present right now in our tabernacles, in our shuls, in our synagogues, in our temples, that we cannot enter, because it's not because limited to the situation, but there's a deeper presence that is here, so that it can't allow us to enter. So now, is that a homiletic? Obviously, I'm playing with homiletics here, but the idea also, though, is that the Gemara tells us that when you have a situation, when you go to visit a sick person, it says you're not really supposed to sit on the edge of the bed, because the presence of God, the Shekhinah, is present. God's presence is felt there. Now, what does that mean? Is that any time that we have a certain situation where life is on the line, you sense that God is there. There's a certain, like, you know, there's something in moments of desperation, you'll actually get a sense of God more than you normally do in the regular course of life. And that perhaps, you know, with our situation, what's going on, you know, it's a pretty crazy world that we're living in. Every moment, you know, things are changing so rapidly, and there's so much question, doubt, and in terms of what's going to be. That in that time, you have this type of situation of the Shekhinah, because when we talk about God, so God's everywhere. God is, he's the infinite, he's the finite, he's in everything, he's everything, we exist within God. But the Shekhinah means, that the word Shekhinah means the presence. Shochein is to dwell. So that when we talk about God and the Shekhinah, we're talking about God feeling God's presence in this world. So when it talks about here, ki shachan alav ha'anan, that God rested he rested in the tabernacle so much so that we couldn't enter. So there are times when we can sense God, we can feel God's presence even more so than normal in regular nature. So that when you have a situation like this, it's like, whoa, you know, it allows us to appreciate life, because this is not, you know, life, the norms of life have changed completely. So that I think that idea was expressed in the parsha a little bit here at this back end. And at the same time, we see here at the back in our Gemara that when Rav Yossi goes into when Rav Yossi goes, I thought there's a history button, but it's not on this thing. Okay. So that when Rav Yossi goes into this place, he's actually able to hear. There's more of a imminence and presence of. He's able to hear this heavenly voice coming through. There's Elijah. There's a lot going on that he knows he can go to in this situation. Okay, so I just thought that was apropos to what we're doing, or to what we're learning here. The Maharal continues a little bit more in this idea of the yud in Yehei, that it should be. I'll leave it there for now in terms of how he develops the futuristic aspect of Yehei Shmirah. Let's go on to the Gemara here. Okay, so we're going to start. We're now back to 3a at the bottom. So we were talking about, okay, so this is just to finish off. We mentioned this last time. The sages taught, for three reasons, one may not enter a ruin: because of suspicion of prostitution, because of the ruin is liable to collapse, and because of demons. three separate reasons seem extraneous. So the Gemara asks, why was the reason because of suspicion necessary? Let this halacha be derived because of collapse, right? Because here he's walking into an old, dilapidated building. He's putting himself into danger. What's he doing here? So the Gemara answers, this halacha applies even if in a case of a new, sturdy ruin, where there is no danger of collapse. Therefore, the reason because of suspicion is cited in order to warn one not to enter a new ruin as well. So, like, obviously, this idea that when you had a ruin, it wasn't a place where people are hanging, so you wanted a private place to go. This was your version of an hourly type of place. So the Gemara continues to object, and let this halacha be derived because of demons. The Gemara answers, demons are only a threat to individuals, so because of demons would not apply to a case where two people enter a ruin together. Okay, so the Gemara objects, but if there are two people entering a ruin together, then there is no suspicion either. There is no prohibition against two men to be alone with a woman, as in that case, there is no suspicion of untold behavior. Consequently, if two men enter a ruin together, there is no room for suspicion. The Gemara answers, if two individuals known to be immoral enter together, there is suspicion, even though there are two of them. So we have this idea, this important idea of yichud. So this became popular, I think, when Pence talked about the idea that he wouldn't go to a meal without his wife, right? If he would meet with a woman, he would never go without his wife. But in Jewish law, we have a halacha called yichud, which says that you cannot be alone with in a house, in a room, by yourself with a woman that's not, you know, a relative. That's not your spouse, and that's called yichud. There's an incredible amount of detail that goes into, like, when does it apply? Are there exceptions? But the general idea is that one should not put themselves in a situation where they're going to come to potentially sin. But it goes so much more than that. Is that there is this idea that the law is prohibiting you, that you're basically violating law, not just acting on it, but we're saying just putting yourself into that situation, that is a prohibition in its own right. That's called yichud. We could spend the whole class, literally, there are multiple, there's so many, you know, different parts to that law, like exactly how it applies. Like, let's say, for example, like, you know, the different combinations, let's say it's you and two other women, that's a problem as well. Depends on if it's your wife, obviously it's not a problem. So, like, it's very interesting to see how, and then we see here this idea that two individuals known to be immoral to enter together, that's already a problem. So there, it's a very, I spent a half a year in college when I was in Yeshiva University, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, we studied the laws of Yichud. It was a very intricate course of study in terms of just all the different caveats that apply. Okay, so now the Gemara responds, there are times when this reason is necessary when two upstanding individuals enter a ruin together. Although there is neither concern of suspicion nor of demons, there remains concern lest the ruin collapse, right? So you have, what it's basically saying is, the reason that the Gemara is basically asking, why do you need all these three reasons? And so it's explaining that each one has its own side point that shows, like, depending on the situation, will apply, won't apply. So therefore, it's giving us a larger, amount of, or a bigger group to work with because of the different scenarios that could come about. So the Gemara considers.
What do they mean by demons, by the way?
What is it?
What do they mean by demons?
Right. So it used to be the Gemara in Bracha has a lot of situations where it talks about shadim. So, or mazikin. Here it's calling it the mazikin. But they used to have this idea. We don't. It pretty much by the time of the Vilna Gaon, which is already 250 years ago, where they already said that demons. Even, I mean, maybe more recently, but they in our time we don't have this issue of demons. But they used to have these other spirits that were there that were damaged or hurt people. Okay, Nishtana Teva, we say that the nature has changed, or, you know, it's, but this seemed to be a real issue in the time of the Gemara. So the Gemara here in Brachas, especially, it comes up a lot, we'll discuss this issue. Okay, so So now, and then, and in general, the working understanding with demons, the issue of addressing that is that if you're by yourself, you're definitely in a danger of potentially being affected by a demon. But with another person, two or more, then you're already protected. So why is it necessary to include because of demons? Let the prohibition be derived from suspicion and collapse. The Gemara responds, there are cases where this is the only concern. For example, where it is a new rune into which two upstanding individuals enter. So there is neither concern, lest a collapse, nor suspicion. But we're saying, so then the Gemara says, but wait a second. The Gemara points out, however, if there are two people, there is also no concern of demons, right? If you're by yourself, that's when you have to be worried. But if you're with another person, demons don't necessarily, they can't. So as such, the question remains, in what case can demons be the sole cause not to enter the rune? So the Gemara responds, generally speaking, two individuals need not be concerned about demons. But if they are in their place, a place known to be haunted by demons, we are concerned about demons even with two people. And if you wish, say instead, actually, this refers to a case of an individual entering a new rune located in a field. Okay, so now, here's the situation, right? So it's a new rune, don't have to worry about it collapsing. You're in the field. There is no suspicion, as finding a woman in the field is uncommon, right? So that basically that kind of stuff occurs in the city, not out in the field. And since it is a new rune, there's no danger of collapse. However, there's still a concern of demons. Okay, great. So that we've just finished Rav Yossi's. So just to conclude here, Rav Yossi goes into this rune. He meets Elijah. He prays there. He has a discussion with Elijah. The takeaway is, God is very much connected to the Jewish people still. He feels the pain of the destruction of the temple. We can connect and we do tremendous things when we say Yehi Shmei Rabbah, when we say the Kaddish. And that, but then off of that, we had this whole discussion about, you know, there's a takeaway. We always have a takeaway from a story. The takeaway is when you're praying in a tight spot, do you say the whole Shemona Esrei or can you go with a shorter version? And that was one of the takeaways. Okay, and then from there, you see, don't go into a place that's dangerous. In general, we have this premise or this idea that a person has to be careful not to put themselves into dangerous situations. By the way, that's interesting. You know, there's a discussion for all those skiers out there. You know, the Gemara asks, or the Gemara, the Halacha discusses this issue of, can you put yourself into a situation of danger? Does skiing qualify in terms of that, you know, would that qualify as a something considered to be quote unquote dangerous, right? Like, are you considered to be endangering your life by going skiing? Now, depends if you're not a good skier, then yeah, I would say yes. But if it's something that you can really get hurt, they can, okay, let's leave skiing alone. But if you put yourself into a situation of real danger, Halacha says you're not allowed to put yourself into real danger. That would be not necessarily an offshoot of this, but this discussion about putting yourself into a dangerous situation, a chorva, it's this idea that you can't put yourself into a dangerous situation. That would be derived off of that. And it comes from the verse in the Torah, which talks about Nishmartem es nafsho seichem, you have to really protect life, which is very much apropos to what we're going through here as well. Right, you really have to. You know, we have a biblical obligation. God says you must protect life. You have to always, first things first. You always have to take good care of yourself. So this idea also would apply to going into that very tricky building that's not necessarily stable. That would qualify as something that you're not allowed to put yourself into that type of situation. Okay, so now, the Gemara goes on here. New thing. So, the Mishnah, back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah had said that there were three opinions as to when could you say the Shema at night. Right, so the first one said to the first watch. The second opinion was to midnight. And the third opinion said that you can say the Shema up until dawn. Until the end of the night. Which is would be the, you know, at dawn. So now, how do we understand when it says the first watch? What is it talking about? So the sages taught in a Tosefta, the night is comprised of four watches. This is a statement of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and Rabbi Natan said the night is comprised of three watches. So is it three or four? So now the Gemara here, just going to go quickly here. What they're basically, how do you understand Is it three watches or four watches? So the Gemara basically, you see how they derive it from, they're looking, you know, they're basically going to say, how did these two get to the opinion of, right? One says, Rebbe said it was four watches in the night. One said it's three. So the Gemara explains their reasoning. So what Rav Natan's reason, as it is written, and Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. It was taught in the Tosefta, middle means nothing other than that there is one before it and one after it. So you give a middle, right? So if you have a middle, it means there's one of the... So the fact that the verse refers to a middle watch, the fact that the night is comprised of three watches may be inferred, okay? But Rebbe, going back here, Rebbe's the one who told us that there are four watches. So what would Rebbe do with this verse? He would say the middle watch is that there are two points in the middle. If you have four, there's two in the middle. So he'll just say the middle means the middle of the middle. Okay. Then, and how would Rav Natan respond? He would say, despite the Rav Yehuda Nasi's objection, is one of the middle watches written in the verse. The middle watch is written. It doesn't say the middle of the middle. It says there's only one middle. Okay. So now, how did Rav Yos, right? So what did Rebbe said that he thought there were four watches? How does he understand it? So Rav Zecharia said, that Rav Ami said, that Rav Yehoshua ben Levi said, and the opinion is based on the comparison of two verses. At midnight, so this is talking about David in Psalms. He says, one verse says, at midnight I rise to give thanks for your righteous laws. And the other verse says, my eyes forestall the watches that I will speak of your word. Taken together, these verses indicate that their author, King David, rose at midnight, two watches before dawn, in order to study Torah. How is it possible to reconcile these two verses? Only if there are four watches in the night, does one who rises two watches before dawn rise at midnight. Okay? So now so Rebbe learns his four watch idea from the fact that he's reconciling these two lines of King David in the Psalms. Okay? Now that's going to become important because we're going to see this idea of the Gemara is actually going to get into a discussion about David, King David, and his practices of midnight. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to actually jump down a little bit here just because we'll skip this last part of this discussion here, okay? And then just get to this point. Rav Ashi said that the verses can be reconciled in accordance with Rabbi Natan's opinion in another way. One and a half watches are called watches, in plural. Therefore, King David could rise at midnight and maintain that he forestalls the watches, meaning because it says watches in the plural too. So he's able to reconcile. The one who says that there are three watches, great, he can understand the reading for that. But Rebbe's also, you know, he says the four watches, therefore when King David gets up in the middle, in midnight, there are two more watches till the beginning of the day. Okay. So as an add-on, he says here, there's this idea, following discussion, another halacha that Rabbi Zbrika said, that Rabbi Ami said, that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, is cited before the dead. One may speak only of matters relating to the dead, as speaking of other matters appears to be contemptuous of the deceased, and discoursing that he is unable to talk while those around him can. Therefore, one must remain fully engaged in matters relating to him. As a secondary law that he says that when it comes to, when you're in front of a dead body, you're not allowed to study Torah because it's like you're mocking the dead because they're not able to and you're doing something that they'd want to do. And so therefore it's not proper. You should just do things that are related to taking care of the dead body to get them ready for burial. Two traditions exist with regard to the detail of this halacha in the name of Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. According to one version, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said the halacha was only said with regard to matters of Torah. Speaking of other matters, however, is not prohibited, since no contempt is exposed for the deceased by the fact that he is unable to speak of such topics, meaning it's limited to just Torah. Don't speak Torah in front of a dead body. Others say, another version of this halacha, in the name of Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, this halacha was said even with regard to matters of Torah, and all the more so with regard to other matters. If one must refrain from speaking of matters of Torah regarding which one is commanded to speak, and limit himself to matters concerning the deceased, all the more so should he refrain from speaking of other matters regarding that which one is not commanded to speak. So that basically, if I'm obligated to talk Torah, and the halacha is telling me don't do that here because it's like mocking the dead, so too other items. Meaning that when you're basically there's this idea that you're mocking the dead if you speak about other things other than just taking care of the deceased, because somehow you're like you're saying, hey, this person can no longer speak, and I'm going to talk about other items. It's just not, it's not respectful. Okay. So now, this is now talking about King David. This is a beautiful idea. So incidental to the Gemara's mention of King David, other sources are cited that describe his actions. Regarding that which was cited above, that he would rise in the middle of the night in order to serve his creator. The Gemara asks, did David rise at midnight? He rose in the evening, as it is written, I rose with Neshef, and cried, I hoped for your word. And how do we know that this Neshef is the evening? As it is written, in the Neshef, in the evening of the day, in the blackness of night and the darkness. So apparently King David did not indeed rise when it was still evening. Apparently King David did indeed rise when it was still evening. But the question is here, what is it? Are we talking about that he rose at midnight or not? This idea of Neshef, it's this word, what is Neshef? Is Neshef evening? What is this idea? We see Neshef used in multiple, in more than one place and a little bit differently. It's not always consistently used the same way. So the Gemara suggests several ways to resolve this contradiction. Rav Oshaya said that Rabbi Aha said, David said as follows, midnight never passed me by in my sleep. So meaning that sometimes I fulfilled the verse, I rose with the Neshef and cried, but I always at least fulfilled the verse, at midnight I rise to give thanks to your righteous laws. So meaning the idea is that King David said, I never missed a midnight where I wasn't up praising God. So now Reb Zera said, until midnight, David dozed like a horse, as a horse dozes, but he never sleeps deeply. From midnight on, he would gain the strength of a lion. Rav Ashi said, until midnight, he would study Torah. As it is written, I rose with the Neshef and cried, I hoped for your word. And from midnight on, he would engage in songs and praise. As it is written, at midnight, I rise to give thanks. So now again, it comes back. What's this Neshef? Is Neshef night? Is it morning? So to this point, the discussion has been based on the assumption that Neshef means evening. The Gemara asks, does Neshef really mean evening? Doesn't Neshef mean morning? As it's written, and David slew them from the Neshef until the evening of the next day. Doesn't this verse mean from the morning until midnight? In which case Neshef could mean morning? So Neshef, what does Neshef mean? Does it mean night? Does it mean day? So the Gemara responds, no. This verse means that David slew them from one evening until the next evening. Okay, so Neshef is consistently meaning evening. So the Gemara rejects this response. If so, let the verse be written from the Neshef until the Neshef, or from the evening until the evening. Why would the verse employ two different terms for a single concept? So the Gemara answers, Rava said, there are two times referred to as Neshef, and the word can refer to either evening or morning. Neshef must be understood in accordance with its Aramaic root. The night moves past Neshef, and the day arrives. And the day moves past, and the night arrives. So Neshef has this meaning. It's not just, if you want to say, like we've seen this before, if you want to say something, you just say it straight out, unless you're saying something different. So Neshef is an expression of night moving, like there's a movement of, so Neshef is night, but it has its moving of this idea of movement. Okay, so now, back to this idea. So David, King David, would get up at midnight and pray. He would give thanks. So when King David said, "At midnight I rise," the assumption is that he rose precisely at midnight. The Gemara asks, did David know exactly when it was midnight? Even Moses, our teacher, did not know exactly when it was midnight. How do we know this about Moses? So this is coming up to the right. We're coming up. Actually, we read it yesterday. This in Exodus 12, when we did HaChodesh, we read about the idea of the plague of the firstborn happened at midnight. So Moses, when he tells Pharaoh and the Egyptians, he tells them it's going to happen at midnight, around midnight. He doesn't say exactly at midnight. He says around midnight. So even Moses, our teacher, did not know exactly when it was midnight. How do we know this about Moses? As it is written that he said to Pharaoh, "Thus said the Lord, about midnight, kichatzos, I will go out into the midst of Egypt." The word "about" indicates that it was only an approximation. So the Gemara clarifies, what is the meaning of the expression "about midnight, kichatzos"? Did Moses say it, or did God say it? If we say the Holy One, blessed be He, Himself said about midnight to Moses, is there a doubt before God in heaven? Does God not know exactly when midnight is? Rather, this must be understood as follows. God told Moses at midnight, but from the fact that when Moses came to Pharaoh, he said about midnight, apparently Moses was uncertain about the exact moment of midnight. So the Moses, the greatest of all prophets, was uncertain, and David knew. So how does that work? Meaning, we're saying that Moses didn't understand exactly when midnight was, but you have King David coming later, who's not on the same level of prophecy, at least, and he knew when midnight was? So the Gemara offers several answers to this question. David had a sign indicating when it was midnight. As Rav Acha Bar Bizna said, that Rav Shimon Hasida said, a lair hung over David's bed, and once midnight arrived, the northern midnight wind would come and cause the lair to play on its own. David would immediately rise from his bed and study Torah until the first rays of dawn. Once dawn arrived, the sages of Israel entered to advise him with regard to various concerns of the nation and the economy. They said to him, "Our master, the king, your nation requires sustenance." He said, "Go and sustain one another, provide each other with whatever is lacking." The sages of Israel responded to him with a parable. A single handful of food does not satisfy a lion, and a pit will not be filled merely from the rain that falls directly into its mouth, but other water must be piped in. So too, the nation cannot sustain itself using its own resources. King David told them, "Go and take up arms with the troops in battle in order to expand our boundaries and provide our people with the opportunity to earn a livelihood." Sounds interesting, right? How do you solve economic issues? Go to war. But the idea is like to expand the borders so that they would be able to find, I guess, whatever was lacking from the economy. But just right now, just to take a stop here, we're seeing, this is going off a little bit on a tangent, but the idea was in asking, so we see right now that King David did have an ability to know exactly when midnight was, okay? So now, in this subject of when they came in to talk to David about the needs of the nation, the sages immediately seek advice from Achitophel to determine whether or not it was appropriate to go to war at that time and how they should conduct themselves. And they consult the Sanhedrin in order to receive the requisite license to wage a war under those circumstances. And they ask the Urim v'Thummim, that's what the breastplate of the Kohen, whether or not they should go to war, and whether or not they would be successful. Okay, so now, just on this point, so Rav Yosef said, upon what verse is the Agada based, as it is written, and after Achitophel was Yehoyada, son of Benayahu, and Yatar, and the general of the king's army, Yoav. So the individuals named in the verse correspond with the roles in the Agada as follows. Achitophel is the advisor whose advice they sought first with regard to going to war. And so it says, now the council of Achitophel which he counseled in those days, was a man who inquires of the word of God. So was the counsel of Achitovel, both with David and with Avshalom. So they have that basically these psukim from Divrei Hayamim, from the Chronicles, and then bringing in from the book of Samuel, they put them together to figure out exactly how they were able to derive that that's what was going on here. Okay, so I'm going. So that's this whole side point about King David advising them to go to war. And then you see actually a system of, it wasn't just like the king's, he says, okay, go to war, and they go to war. They actually had a whole checks and balance system where they went to other parts of the hierarchy or the power structure. They went to the Sanhedrin, they went to the temple, and they did all this consulting to see whether or not they should do that. So it's interesting to see that it wasn't just a king that could do everything in command and everything would just happen, that they actually had more of a balanced system. But either way, back to King David. So we're on this issue of, does King David knew the time of midnight and Moses did not? So Rav Zera offered a different solution to the question of whether Moses and David knew exactly when it was midnight, and said Moses certainly knew when it was midnight, and David also knew. But so now, if David knows, so the Gemara asks first, if David knew, then why did he need his lair? The Gemara answers, he needed the lair to wake him from his sleep. So basically, the lair worked as an alarm clock, got him out of bed. What's interesting is that we talked about this earlier, that there was a midnight wind that came, that was able to make the lair make its music. So you had a cool built-in alarm clock there. Now, it says that similarly with regard to Moses. So now, what's going on with Moses? So Moses, he says to Pharaoh, like midnight, around midnight, but he doesn't say exactly on midnight. But it sounds like it's that Moses doesn't understand when midnight is. So the Gemara says no. Similarly, with regard to Moses, since Moses knew the precise moment of midnight, why did he say about midnight instead of at midnight? Moses did so because he maintained lest Pharaoh's astrologers make the mistake, error, and believe midnight to be earlier. Since no disaster would have occurred, they would say Moses a liar. Moses spoke in accordance with the principle articulated by the master, accustom your tongue to say, I do not know, lest you become entangled in a web of deceit. So Moses understood, he was concerned that it shouldn't look like he was being inaccurate. Okay, so therefore, he gives over the message and says, Kichatzos, like midnight, but not exactly, because he was not worried about himself. He knew exactly when midnight was. But he was worried that the astrologers on the Egyptian side would not get it right, and then they would think that Moses wasn't being accurate. Okay, so it's interesting that the importance of giving over accurate accounts is paramount. Okay. Okay, so now, this is also, again, apropos to the oncoming holiday of Passover, right? Because here we're talking about with Passover, right? The apex of the 10 plagues was the last one was the Makot Bechorot, was the plague of the firstborn, and that happened at midnight, or did it happen? Right, it happened at midnight. So Rav Ashi said, the question is unfounded. As Moses was standing at midnight on the 13th, leading into the 14th, when he pronounced his prophecy, and Moses told Israel that the Holy One, blessed be He, said that tomorrow, at the exact time, like midnight tonight, I will go out into the midst of Egypt. This indicates that the passage should not be understood to mean about midnight, an approximation, but rather like midnight, as a comparison, likening midnight tomorrow to midnight tonight, right? So it's a whole different thing. Originally, when we looked at it, we said, he's saying it's an approximation, but now we're saying, no, he's just saying, no, it's like this midnight. Kichatzos, not that it's going to be around midnight. He's saying it's like this midnight. He's on the 13th. It's going to happen tomorrow night at this exact time. So it's like this midnight. You hear it? So it's a different, right? That's we thought it was kichatzos. It's going to be it's around midnight. Now we're saying it's similar to this midnight, the next night. Okay. So that's another interesting way to read the pasuk, right? So Ravashiyam or Bapalga or the place in Nagi Abesar Havikai, Vahikam or Moshe, right? So he's just saying it's going to be like this. It's going to be like tonight. Okay. So the Gemara further explores King David's character and said, a prayer of David, keep my soul, for I am pious. Right? L'David shamra nafshi ki chasid ani. So now, how do we understand that? David is saying, keep my soul, for I am pious. Levi and Rabbi Yitzchak debated the meaning of this verse and how David's piety is manifest in the fact that he went beyond his fundamental obligations. One said, David's declaration of piety referred to his awakening during the night to pray. And so said David before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe. Am I not pious? As all of the kings of the east and the west sleep until the third hour of the day, but but although I am a king like them, at midnight I rise to give thanks. So David is saying to God, am I not a righteous person? Which is, again, we have to understand, what does it mean that he's saying, here I am a righteous person, I'm pious? How does that work? To say something like that? It's kind of a strange thing for him to be saying about himself. But the other one explained, the other sage said, David said the following before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe, am I not pious? For all of the kings of the east and the west sit in groups befitting their honored status, but I sit as a judge who issues rulings for the people. So now here we're going to get a very interesting view into King David, which we didn't, here you're thinking king, royalty, pomp, luxury. So what's King David doing? So it says that women come with questions of ritual impurity, and my hands become soiled with their blood as I labor to determine whether or not it is blood of impurity, and she was menstruating, has a menstruating woman status, meaning she have a status of Anita, and with a fetus that miscarried at a stage of development before it was clear whether or not it is considered a birth, and with placenta, which women sometimes discharge unrelated to the birth of a child. So you see this idea when the Gemara understands that King David was sitting there and he was ruling, he was actually issuing rulings in laws of Nida, of family purity, and also with, God forbid, a child being lost, whether or not that was considered to be, depending on where, when the child this fetus, would determine different laws around that. So King David is sitting there as a judge, right? He's actually making rules. He's ruling on these things. So King David went to all this trouble in order to render a woman ritually pure and consequently permitted to her husband. If after examination, a sage declares the woman ritually pure, she's permitted to be with her husband, which leads to increased love and affection and ultimately to procreation. And not only do I engage in activity considered to be beneath the station of a king, but I consult my teacher, Mephibosheth, the son of King Saul's son, Jonathan, with regard to everything that I do. I say to him, Mephibosheth, my teacher, did I decide properly? Did I convict properly? Did I acquit properly? Did I rule ritually pure properly? Did I rule ritually impure properly? And I was not embarrassed, for foregoing royal dignity should make me worthy of to be called pious. So basically, so you have two claims or two understandings. So we have a line where King David says, am I not righteous? One is that this idea that he gets up in the midnight to pray when other kings are rolling over in bed. And then the second version is that what's his piety? Or what's his piety is that he's actually rolled up his sleeves and he's busy involved in making judgments to help the Jewish people in their day-to-day lives of, family purity, etc. So we see this idea. I'm getting a sense of like what King David was about. I mean, here's the author of the Psalms. If you take out the Psalms and you read them, you realize that we're talking about, you know, a very holy, very connected, very poetic, very deep person, King David. But now we're also getting a sense of the amount of his willingness to sacrifice for the people, right? So this idea that he spent this time, and not only that, but he was willing to forgo his dignity to basically kind of give in or succumb to Mephibosheth's, would give him a hard time, but he would go and ask whether he ruled things properly, right? So you see this idea of his humility, right? So King David, right? So we see this idea that he's completely devoted to God. He's willing to get up midnight. He's praying. He's devoted to the study of Torah. He's also devoted to the Jewish people in giving up his time, right? So he's not the king who's sitting back and enjoying life. He's a king who, this is really like, we're getting a sense of like what it means to be a Jewish king. This is a very interesting idea that when we talk about the Jewish royalty, if you look back at the lineage of King David, there's multiple stories of the evolution of the family, where you have multiple times where the idea of Yibam comes up. Now, Yibam means, I think it translated, you say it in English as Levirate marriage, which basically the idea is that if you have someone that passes away, they're married, husband dies, no child. So his wife is supposed to do Yibam, which means that she should get married to the closest brother or family member of the deceased. So again, this is predicated on having not had a child. If they did not have a child, Levirate marriage says that the next closest relative should marry her and they should have a child, and it would be that child is name should be tied to the person who had died. Levirate marriage. The idea of Levirate marriage in its essence is saying that there's this idea that someone's willing to forgo their identity, right? Because the person's going to step into the shoes of the deceased and basically say, I'm going to be a surrogate, so to speak. I'm going to be the husband that this guy couldn't end up being, the father that he couldn't be. I'm going to step in. So I'm willing to forgo my identity in order to help the identity of the deceased be extended. There are multiple situations in King David's lineage. It goes back to right from Judah had two sons. He ends up having relations with one of his kids, with his daughter-in-law, but it's a basis of Yibam. Then we have, again, later on, the famous story of Ruth and Boaz. That's a case of Levirate marriage, where you see this idea, there's multiple scenarios of Yibam, of Levirate marriage being conducted within the lineage of King David. Now, why does it matter? So the Chiddush, the idea of that is that this is the, when you're coming to Jewish royalty is predicated on this concept of basically sacrificing one's own identity for the people. Like the idea of a Jewish king is to literally give up your own personal identity and to take on the identity of the people. That's what a Jewish king is. Jewish leadership is to sacrifice personal identity, personal whatever, need, necessity, and to then become the identity. Malchus, when you talk about royalty in Kabbalistic writings, it's the same idea. The idea of a melech is the idea of the flag. What's a flag? If we think about a flag is an identity. It symbolizes the nation. The idea of a king and the idea of Jewish royalty is the idea of being able to create a unified identity of the greater whole. And so Jewish royalty, King David, his whole lineage based on this Levirate marriage concept, and the idea is to get to a place of sacrificing the individual's identity, creating, becoming the identity of the whole. And then what happens is that then that king becomes a unifier. Malchus, the idea of Melech, of king, is to unify the people, to create a unified one, a singular identity. It's how do you do that? By giving up one's own individual identity to taking on the identity of the klal, of the general people, you become the people. So to the point of, like, we even see it today, like, you, if you look at, like, British royalty, it's a strange fascination that, you know, what royalty, like, has people identify with the monarch. They identify with the queen, right? So they, like, they have this strange, because like the British, like, it's like they're connected to her somehow, because the monarch takes on the identity of the nation. So that's the Havdil, if we say, like, to separate, because now we're talking about this loftiness of King David, and that Jewish royalty is the idea that we have a person, individual, that becomes, we identify and unify under that identity, under that person. So King David and where he comes from, and how the Levirate, how that whole process of how we get there to Jewish royalty, is very much it's vital, because it defines what it means to what it means to be a Jewish king. So I'm not sure why my video is not coming back on, but so be it. I don't know. I can stick with my screen. So the takeaway, one of the takeaways from the Gemara here is that you see that the Gemara then goes on and talks about that Mephibosheth, who David made as his rabbi, his teacher, the name Boshet is to be embarrassed, that he had no embarrassment. He wasn't willing. He was willing to give up. King David was willing to be embarrassed in order to become, to be able to get truth. And so that's why his teacher was called Mephibosheth, because he caused David to be embarrassed. But the idea is that his willingness, right? So the idea of King David was, again, his willingness to give up his own personal nigiyot, his own personal, pride, in order to be able to strive for truth. But the whole idea of Jewish royalty is to be willing to give up completely on oneself in order to become the people and to become the unifier of the people. So that's pretty much, we'll stop here. Just one other thing. This last part. With regard to David's statement, "Keep my soul, for I am pious," the Gemara asks, did David call himself pious? Isn't it written, "If I had not believed to look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living"? The dots that appear over the word lulei in the text indicate doubt and uncertainty of his piety, whether he was deserving of a place in the land of the living. Meaning, King David questioned. Here's this pious King David, but obviously, the beauty of, just as a very important parenthetical, King David sinned. The Torah talks of it, the Navi tells us that King David sinned. There are these famous sins of King David. But the greatness of David was that he was able to do tshuva. He did repentance. He admitted his mistakes. And that was his greatness also. The idea of his greatness is that he was willing to always acknowledge that. And it started with his great-great-grandfather, Judah, who also was willing to admit his mistake that happened within the story of Tamar. So in the name of Rabbi Yossi, it was taught in the Tosefta, why do the dots appear over the word lulei? As if there are some reservations, because David said before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe, I have every confidence in you that you grant an excellent reward to the righteous in the world to come, since God's ultimate goodness is manifest in the land of eternal life. But I still harbor uncertainty with regard to myself, and I do not know whether or not I definitely have a portion among them. In any case, apparently, David was uncertain whether or not he deserved to receive a portion of God's reward for the righteous. How then could he characterize himself as pious? So the Gemara responds, his concern does not prove anything, as King David knew that he was pious. He was simply concerned lest a transgression that he might commit in the future will cause him to lose his opportunity to look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. So this idea that he knew he was... So what's the takeaway? King David teaches us many things, but a takeaway is that he understood his goodness. There was nothing wrong with being objective about who you are. If you're a good guy, if you do good things, there's nothing wrong with recognizing, I'm a good guy, I do good things, and to feel good about it. It's actually very important to feel good about it. But at the same time, to also always be critically honest with oneself and to say, I can always be better. Not to the point of detriment to be, you know, make yourself crazy, but to the idea that we have always room to improve. We also have to be honest about where we have to make amends. So there's always it's basically, we see this idea, the fact that someone can say, I'm a pious person, means that he understood who he was. At the same time, he questioned whether or not he would somehow mess up somewhere along the way. That's recognizing the frailty of humanity, is that we mess up. But at the same time, to be always wanting to, you know, set things right is what's important. Okay, so we'll stop the Gemara part here.